You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. How you doing today? It's a pretty good bet that rigorous social distancing has you feeling socially isolated. You might not be getting together physically with friends and family, but you can still make some connections, even fall in love in the time of COVID-19. Even, dare I say, move in together. Take, for example, 23-year-old Roxy Pekemian.
It just seemed like almost a sign that, you know, I think it's time. I'll be able to build a relationship with her while still working from home. It'll be able to, honestly, just for mental health, it'll be good to have a little friend wandering around the apartment during this time of extreme uncertainty.
Roxy has fallen in love with a dark-haired beauty named Gilly.
It's like I expected to have at least a little bit of a learning curve with, you know, having a cat for the first time, but we were immediately best friends. She was licking my face within 10 minutes of meeting me, and I just completely fell in love.
After years of yearning for a cat, she fostered a black short hair kitty at a local rescue. The next day, Roxy filled out a questionnaire about what the cat was like to help place her with the Forever family.
I saw this list of questions, and I just felt this overwhelming urge to lie, because I did not want them to know that she was the most perfect animal I had ever met, because I didn't want anyone else to take her. I had a nice long conversation with myself and said, if you're legitimately worried about telling the truth about how good your cat is because someone might take her, maybe you take her yourself.
She says her new roommate helps structure her time and gives meaning to her days.
Having someone or something to take care of gives you a schedule. It regulates what you're doing with your day. And so when you're spending a lot of time alone, not interacting with anyone, having a creature that is breathing, that depends on you to take care of it, is one, an honor, the fact that I get to take care of a beautiful little kitty, but two, it gives me purpose to my day, right?
In the second week of March, as businesses and schools shut down, people all over America, like Roxy, rush to take in new pets. According to PetPoint, that's a data system for animal wellness agencies, pet fostering nearly doubled that week, and then saw an additional 80% rise the week after. More on new love in the face of COVID-19. And KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo.
At the Pasadena Humane Society and SPCA, Chris Ramone manages the Animal Foster Program. As COVID-19 started to make its way through Southern California, Ramone got nervous. The shelter needed to reduce its staff in order to safely social distance. Ramone worried no one would be thinking about pet adoptions, and where would the animals go?
We really had to just switch our focus from a vulnerable population to we need to get everybody out right now, because the goal around that was if we can get the population to as close to zero on campus, then that would allow for a skeleton crew so that we could allow for physical distancing and not having to have the people that work here in close quarters on a regular basis.
So they turned to social media, posting cute furry pictures of homeless cats and dogs, and the results blew them away.
It was amazing to see that first kind of wave of emails that came in that said, I'm being asked to stay home for the next 2 or 3 weeks because of COVID-19. So since I'm here, let me go ahead and foster an animal, since they knew that we needed the help. It was really as simple as just really putting out a plea for help and then responding to people as they reached out to us.
The Pasadena Humane Society has been inundated by foster and adoption requests. They received more than 1,500 emails in the past month, all asking how to lend a hand. And Pasadena is not alone. Shelters across Los Angeles have seen similar rises in foster and adoption numbers. What is it about these furry animals? Karen North, a clinical professor of communication at USC, says maybe as we're taking care of them, they're also taking care of us.
You know, you can think about the fact that what they're doing is basically, you know, for lack of a better way of explaining it, bringing a service animal, bringing emotional support into their houses to take care of themselves if they're alone, or their children if their children are in distress, which everybody's in distress right now. So bringing in an animal is one way of meeting some emotional needs and providing emotional support for for those of us who are in distress, which is pretty much everybody these days.
North wants to make sure, though, that pet adopters are not taking on more than they can handle. Sometimes overwhelmed people are not the best pet parents.
I do worry that in times of distress, people are more drawn to try to take on a pet because they think that they need it, and they forget that although their needs are being met, they also have to give back and actually care for a living thing.
That caring for another living thing, when done right, can also help those who work with animals professionally. Take Mara Rodriguez, a zookeeper at Moore Park College, a community college near Simi Valley. The school is home to a teaching zoo that houses exotic animals such as tigers, hyenas, and monkeys. A small group of staff, including Rodriguez as well as student volunteers, have been taking care of the animals since COVID-19 all but shut down campus.
I feel so blessed that I'm around this group of animals that has no idea what's going on in the world. They really never do. What their reality is what's happening here and their day-to-day life here.
Rodriguez has worked with animals her entire professional career, and she says the animals at the zoo make her happy, like the goats.
I just walked two goats, and I haven't felt that much joy in my heart in so long, because the unfortunate events that surround all of us right now, I just forgot about them for a good 20 minutes as I, you know, ran around the zoo with these goats who were funny and eating their yams and carrots like it was the greatest tasting thing they've ever had.
Going into work serves as a reminder for her that there's more to life than just the pandemic.
It's really a great perspective to have because it keeps you in check. And if you can't just remember that, you know, eventually life will get back to normal and there are so many good things around us in this world, being around these animals does that for me. And I know it does it for everybody else here. I am grateful to interact with all of these animals and just look in their eyes and see hope and see that everything's going to be okay.
Rodriguez says it's comforting to know that in our time of need, our four-legged friends have got our backs, whether that's a cat, dog, or even a goat. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Continuing on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Bags of cash bribes exchanged in bathrooms, female escorts sent to Vegas hotel rooms, plea deals with the feds. Yeah, it sounds like an episode of The Sopranos, but it's actually an episode, a long-running episode, of the FBI's ongoing investigation at Los Angeles City Hall. John Rigardi's been closely following the investigation, writing about it for LA Magazine. You might remember he was also the longtime executive editor of LA Downtown News. Hi, John.
Hey, Steve.
There is a lot going on here, and to be clear, the feds have not said anything about the investigation since it is ongoing, but there is this treasure trove of information in court filing. So I want to start with City Councilman Jose Huizar. That was the first action in this investigation back in November of 2018. What's the latest news on Huizar? He still hasn't been charged with anything, right?
Exactly. And officially, according to the federal investigators, he has not been named. But what has happened very recently is there was a man named Justin Kim. He is a sort of political fixer, real estate consultant. And just a few weeks ago, he agreed to plead guilty to federal corruption charges. He was, you know, serving as a middleman. Real quickly, there was a developer who wanted to get a project built and accept the the project was being opposed by a local labor group. Justin Kim stepped in to sort of help the developer try to get this fixed, had a relationship with a council member, and they worked out a deal where there would be $500,000 paid by the developer to make this opposition from the union go away. And again, no one was ever officially named, but in FBI documents, it does refer to a council member known as Council Member A, who was on the council's Planning and Land Use Management Committee, and also who had a relative who was running to replace the council member. Everybody, it took them about, one nanosecond to go, oh yeah, Council Member Jose Huizar, he was on the Plum Committee, and his wife, Rochelle, was going to be running for his seat. So everyone real quickly put, two and two together, and that is the situation where things are now, though important, as you mentioned, to note that there have not been any arrests of the council member, nor has he been charged with any crime.
But these are in the court filings that we're seeing. People are obviously presumed innocent until proven guilty. This is how we go about the legal situation. But that I can only think of the $500,000 now. So how do people quiet down in the opposition when $500,000 is on the table? What do you do to get that $500,000 to these folks?
In this case, there was a series of meetings. And one of my favorite things from this is there was a situation where one night the developer, Justin Kim, and the council member all met in, ta-da, a karaoke room. They came together. They discussed, they discussed how this, would be achieved. I had so many questions, many of which just involved which songs these guys were all doing between rounds of negotiating. Ultimately, they did come to this figure. Money was then handed. You had $400,000 that was handed over at first in cash in a paper bag and went to a staff member in Council Member A's office. Now, what's also really interesting from these documents is it's actually unclear if the council member ever actually got the money or if the staff member was holding on to it. You read through these documents, it's like this amazing legal thriller, but with boneheaded criminals, and there's all these text messages that reference the council member asking for the money to be handed over, but then the staff member totally ghosting the council member in terms of that. Again, this stuff is worth reading.
Then there's Councilman Mitch Englander, who suddenly left his Valley Council seat back in 2018. He's agreed to plead guilty. What was he being charged with? Is this all along the same lines?
The Mitch Englander case is really amazing. A truly epic thing to watch. Real quickly, essentially, there was another business person who has been referred to as business person A, was involved in real estate. And essentially, the business person wanted to get their products more widely adopted, used through developments. The business person bankrolled this epic night out in Las Vegas back in June 2017 with Mitch Englander and other individuals. It's been talked about before, but there was a $2,500 dinner. There was a $34,000 bar bill. I don't know how you possibly rack up that much money. And then there was a female escort allegedly sent to Councilman Englander's hotel room. Mitch Englander, when all of this broke back on March 9th, and the former councilman was facing 7 counts and up to 50 years in prison. 18 days later, so pretty quick, there was an agreement, and Mitch Englander agreed to plead guilty to just 1 count and now faces a maximum of 5 years in prison. As one person who follows federal investigations very closely, a source of mine said for the story, that is a really good deal. You don't get that kind of deal unless you are going to provide a lot of really good information to federal authorities and probably agree to testify in trial should it be needed.
I mean, this is so bizarre, but it does sound like an episode of The Sopranos or something like that, where, a lot of things happen. The old line is, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, right? Do we know what happened in Vegas?
We know a lot about what happened in Vegas because thanks to the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice, it's all spelled out in these documents. Again, there's the references to business person A bankrolling, this incredible evening out that involved a dinner of nearly $2,500, a $34,000 bar bill, the female escort being sent up to the then council member's room, not to mention $15,000 in cash handed over to Mitch Englander in two separate transactions, both in bathrooms.
You've covered City Hall, John, for a long, long time. Is this how city business is done? I mean, this is a lot of, obviously, we're laughing at this and there's a lot going on and it does mimic something that you'd see on HBO. But obviously, this can't be the way city business is done.
You're right. We are making jokes about this, but this is incredibly serious. And I really hope it's not how things are normally done. And I can't assume that every transaction, happened this way. But there is a lot of suspicion about a pay-to-play atmosphere. And there's long been, speculation, suspicion that, those with the most money can get the most influence. There certainly have been attempts, even within City Hall to reduce the influence. You had council member David Rue, who had been pushing to prohibit, donations from developers who have business before City Hall, as well as, prohibiting behested payments. But efforts over the years to, stop these kind of things have really been, watered down, unfortunately. There's never been the, real clear transparency or demarcation of exactly what goes on and how. I think everyone is hoping that, these cases are outliers, that if it was really like this all the time, there would have already been significant steps. But again, if there is at least a bright side on this, it's that with two big plea deals announced within 8 days, that things are moving forward and potentially we're reaching a climax, which could set the table to hopefully a cleaner, more transparent era within Los Angeles.
You think there are other occupants at City Hall who might be a little worried about this investigation?
I think there are absolutely others in City Hall who have to be worried about what's going on at this time. The FBI doesn't really mess around. They are very careful in their statements. And the press release for Englander's agreement, as I put in my story, states that a businessman was working with investigators on a public corruption investigation focused on suspected pay-to-play schemes involving Los Angeles public officials. That's officials. That's with an S. That's plural. People should be very concerned about what's coming down the pipeline.
It's a giant story in L.A., I tell you that much. John Rigardi writing about that federal investigation of City Hall for Los Angeles Magazine. John, as always, great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And now, off to the OC. Well, public health officials are saying that California appears to be bending the curve with COVID-19 cases. And that means with increased testing and continued social distancing, hopefully the hospitals and their healthcare workers and equipment will not be stretched beyond capacity. But in Orange County, rates of testing lag behind nearby counties, which means the OC may not really know how many people have COVID-19 and may not be fully prepared when cases peak. It's Monday. That means Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Obviously, this is an issue pretty much everywhere in the United States. It's hard to know exactly how many people have it because the testing has been so spotty and it's so crucial now. How does testing in the OC compare to other nearby counties?
So let's just go from the top to the bottom. In California, the rate for COVID-19 testing goes 4,100 per 1 million. In San Diego County, which is of same size around as Orange County, but obviously bigger geographically, 6,000 per 1 million. Los Angeles County, 5,000 per 1 million. Orange County, for all its riches and all its hype, 3,500 tests per million residents.
So why so much lower in Orange County?
two crucial things. One of them the entire state suffers from, which is a lack of resources, a bottleneck of testing. So all counties suffer that. But what's interesting in Orange County, especially compared to the other counties, that the county of Orange as of yet is not testing or is not offering testing for the public. So we're talking about the county of Orange, the government itself. Los Angeles County, if you're a resident, you could go to a couple of places where the county of Los Angeles will test you. San Diego County, the same, but not in Orange County. And they're trying, though. The sheriff's department, they said we could convert our own crime lab. We could start doing some testings, but they're saying that the FDA is saying right now, not yet, you know, the regulations and all that.
Again, we talk about the problem with testing, how spotty it's been all across the country. So that's really the case in Orange County, that we don't have a sense of how many people have coronavirus.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everywhere in the United States, in the world, really. But in Orange County, the health officials, they're saying, yeah, we really don't know. I mean, we're trying to test. We're trying to ramp up the testing. We're trying to get more. But until we're at a point comparable to other counties, we're just not going to have the clearest sense. And of course, they're tracking it every single day. They're releasing the figures and whatnot. And it's going around, you know, the last case, the last number was about 1,200 cases in the county, 19 deaths. But county officials are kind of driving blind into this.
All right, we're talking about, obviously, the issue, right, which is testing. Now the ramifications. Let's talk about preparation, what officials are saying about when the peak in cases and hospitalizations. That's what we're really looking at, is how many people are getting sick and having to go to the hospital. Are they prepared for this?
The hospitals say they are. I mean, Orange County does have a lot of great hospitals, both, you know, the richer ones like Koch Hospital, the more working class ones, St. Joseph's, a lot of systems there. And they're saying that they're ready to hit the peak. Of course, when the peak's going to be, we really don't know. We were supposed to be going through the peak already. There was actually a study a couple of weeks ago from UCI scientists that are saying, oh, Orange County's got to go through the same toll the way Italy did. And thank God we haven't seen that just yet. So now they're saying the peak's probably going to be about May, but also, at least as with the current testing that we're seeing, you're also county officials are also saying there's some sort of leveling off. So that's also something good to celebrate. But again, we're not going to know until there's more testing.
What about data collection by hospitals, Gustavo, for cases of COVID-19? There have been some inconsistencies there, right?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes hospitals report, sometimes they don't report. Well, you're not really going to be able to get a clear number or clear rates if you're not reporting all the times. And the hospitals themselves, they say, well, you know, everyone's trying as much as possible. There's no real scandal. That said, well, we better be as accurate as possible, because obviously coronavirus has affected the livelihoods of everyone. And the more accurate accounts and the more testing that we have, not just everywhere, but obviously in Orange County, the better off everyone's going to be, and the better off everyone's going to be prepared, and the better off we're going to be able to save lives and also livelihoods.
Last week, we talked to you, Gustavo, about your wife Delilah's restaurant of the same name and how you're pitching in to keep it going. Still washing dishes over there?
Washing dishes and cashier and also a delivery driver every once in a while for Alta Baja Market, yes.
You guys are in survival mode right now, obviously. I mean, is this something that can sustain itself at least for a little while?
For a little while, yeah. But I mean, we shouldn't be in the business where very few people are coming. Like, she has to pay the rent. She has to pay the bills, just like all restaurants across the United States, but obviously specifically in Southern California. So the best I could ask folks is thank them for coming to patronize to Alta Baja Market, but really urge everyone, just patronize, get takeout as much as possible. Go ask your local favorite restaurants. What do they need right now? What do they need right now to be able to survive? And what do they need in the future? And please, please, please do that, because the livelihoods of so many people are out there.
Yeah, that can be said about any mom and pop shop all across this country. So something to watch. Gustavo Arellano, who writes for the LA Times every Monday, of course, a regular here on Greater LA for Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, as far as the weather goes, we had a few scattered showers earlier this morning. Still a little cloudy, though, across the Southland. I think we will clear up, see some sunshine if you want to take that walk with the mask and social distancing from everybody else on the sidewalk. Today's high, mid-upper 60s. Next chance of rain, might see a shower or two later this week on Thursday, Friday. Not a giant chance, a few scattered showers in the forecast. Highs mostly in the 60s, although we do warm up. as we get into tomorrow and Wednesday with highs into the mid and upper 70s, might touch 80 in some spots by Wednesday. That's going to do it for us today. Check us out online. You're there a lot these days, aren't you? KCRW.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Share your thoughts with us, too. Before I go, I got to tell you, the audio world lost a broadcast genius over the weekend, and we lost a member of the family here. KCRW's Matt Holzman has been a part of this station for more than 20 years. He was a terrific colleague, a friend to many of us. I'm still a little numb that it happened in the middle of this pandemic and a situation that served up a lot of anxiety anyway. Matt had cancer. He found it late. I guess that's a lesson for all of us. Pay attention to your body. He paid attention to the world, knew exactly how to articulate it. So we're going to have a special tribute to Matt today coming up at 2 o'clock. His podcast, The Document, a couple of great episodes that he loved doing. I hope you'll stay tuned for that. 2 o'clock today on KCRW. On the other side of the business, which is next, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great day.